competition and quarters. Each one to win a good one.
Son of the Lion of the tribe of Judah. Therefore he was condemned because he was accused of claiming kingship against the kingdom of Herod and the kingdom of Caesar. These points are again paralleled in the days of Khan. Here we have the world king representing the great pattern of the law, who has come with the greatest strength and power that man can bring for the salvation of his people. He comes to preach the true doctrine. He comes as the warrior of the law, probably somewhat parallel to the Japanese concept of Fudo-myo, the flaming, demon-like appearance of Buddha. He comes as the avenger and the defender. He comes to warn the world that no man can break the law and survive. But in this case, his enemies raised against him not only the fault of claiming temporal kingship, but ridiculed him as a pretender. I think we can see this working out in the story of man's philosophy also. How many today would believe, for example, in the immutable operation of rebirth and karma? How many would accept the fact that the universe is a great moral structure, a great ethical complex, that it is in truth and reality the absolute wisdom syndrome, that it is the self-sustaining, self-managing, all-governing power? How many would acknowledge that we are the citizens of a moral universe, and that we cannot with impunity break the rules and the laws? This was more or less the dilemma of the Geza Khan. For like universal law, he was ridiculed. He was ignored. Every effort was made to destroy his empire. It was the empire of truth. Everything was done to betray him, to pervert the law. Men claiming in their selfishness that there was no law but their own ambition, turning to the law to destroy it in order that they could maintain a world of ignorance, superstition, and fear. Thus, his subjects, over-influenced by their temporal leaders, turned upon Gaza of Ling in the same way as the people of Jerusalem, aroused by the priests, turned upon Jesus. And those that had first glorified then cried out, "Crucify." This was paralleled very closely in the Gaza story, but with this one difference, that in the Gaza of Ling episode, the personality is very thin, and underneath it, the pattern of the meaning is rather obvious, more obvious perhaps than where we build a strong historical situation, which we are most prone to accept. But in the Gaza of Ling, the king of the law is, of course, the agent of Shambhala, the city of the law. Gaza of Ling was ordained in Chang Shambhala to be the instrument and vassal of the law. He was therefore sent forth to defend the law, to be its hero, to preserve it against corruption, to strive for it, live for it, and if necessary, die for it.
He was appointed as
he was therefore the holy soldier.
Human and superhuman.
He was, as we say it in Europe so many times, the defender of the faith.
The law,
and yet the conspiracies rose against him. And in many instances, these conspiracies would have succeeded had it not been that in the moments of greatest emergency, the apparition of Padmasambhava, the projection of the wizard teacher, came to him, counseled him, and gave him that Merlin-like instruction. Here we also almost see or sense the presence of Gunamon, the old knight of the Parsifal cycle. Padmasambhava remained the instructor, the Merlin, the wise man, and in most instances was able ultimately to enable Gezer of Lin to achieve the purposes for which he had come into the world to fulfill. As time went on, of course, the great battle, which in the Nordic cycle ends in the Ragnarok, the end of the old world and the end of the world of the gods, closed in upon Gezer of Lin. He won all the battles, but he lost the war. He went on and on, struggling, striving, more and more enmeshed in the mysterious sorcery of circumstance, in a wonderful, mysterious way. He again parallels the problem of modern ethics. We speak of justice, but we are unjust. We speak of honor, but we are dishonorable. We talk of law, and then we compromise it. There must be, in one moment, support Gezer of Lin, and in the next moment, we betray him. All the intricate and wonderful happenings of this life are, to the Tibetan and Mongolian mind, a proper subject for infinite fabulizing. And we can see why this would be true. Any instance in human life, any circumstance in which any creature passes, could be one of the innumerable adventures of Gezer of Lin. Because Gezer, in this sense, is every man. It's a miracle play of that name. Gezer of Lin is our problem. The days we spend, the nights we walk the floor. Gezer is the little conspiracy which affects every one of us. For he is the image of our common problems. He is the image of our common struggle, our fight for survival against the closing pressures of adverse circumstances. Everywhere the hero struggles on, only to finally fall under the blows which he cannot. And the whole pattern was, of course, established by Buddha in the beginning, where he told firmly that the doctrine would gradually vanish from the earth, that men would therefore have to wait with whatever patience their karma could provide until the advent of the next recorded history. After having passed through all the adventures and vicissitudes of a very intensely diversified career, Gezer of Lin finally came to the end of the story. One way or another, the world hero always dies. Because this is a Buddhist world hero, living in a world of Buddhist conception, he would not die of the sword, nor would he naturally do so in the symbolism as it would apply to Eastern religion and philosophy. We find Gezer of Lin seated upon a rock, with him four of those who had been true through all the ages, his four nearest and dearest friends. They sat together in meditation. Suddenly there was a great flash of light. The five disappeared together. All that remained was the rock of their empty robe. They had gone back into the mystery of the Shine Shambhala of which they had come. And there, according to the legend, they still wait. Wait for the fulfillment of the end of the prophecy, the cycle that must yet be fulfilled. Now, the prophecy of the Geza Khan goes on in this way. After it was obviously impossible to achieve at that time the fulfillment of the world's desire, a prophecy was given that the land would come under great evils, that one by one the houses of wisdom would be deserted or destroyed. Little by little the teachers would be persecuted, the monasteries would be empty, the books would be burned, and all that had been a great and wonderful world would return again to the desert from which it had come. And in the transformation, the keeping of the world would pass to the despot, to the false one, to those who reviled the law, betrayed it, and those who martyred its saints. And there would be a great and terrible darkness, a darkness of hopelessness. The body of the faithful would be scattered in many lands beyond the borders of the world. Early in the present century, the situation in Asia became increasingly acute. Travelers who visited not only Tibet, but traveled the long caravan route, men exploring like Roy Chapman Andrews, or seeking the mysteries of the old culture like Sir Orrell Stein. These men camped with the pilgrims, camped with the merchants on the caravan route. And as early as about the time of World War I, legends began to flow along the caravan route. Legends to the effect that a great crisis was coming, a crisis that men had never known before. And the oracles, the living prophets of Tibet, began to speak of this. But Allah is the name of a heathen. And everywhere, it seemed that the world was rushing on to catastrophe. A catastrophe greater than men had ever known. But the Mongol and the Tibetan seemed to have a faith that we do not have. They seemed to have hopes and convictions that have not sunk very deeply into the consciousness of Western man. But even these poor wanderers from the sand and under the stars had something of a deep, abiding faith in them. But the rumors kept coming along, the reports that the great sessions of the immortals in the luminous palace of Shambhala, that the wise and the good and the noble of all the worlds were gathered there, that the Buddhas of the ten regions had assembled in solemn conclave in the mysterious house of the law, that this great light shone forever from the ramparts, and the wind horses carried the messages to the other corners of the world. The report was that the time has come for the appearance of the King of the World, that he must come in a strange and wonderful way like the baptizer of old, crying out, prepare the way of the Lord and make his paths straight. That the edict of the law was that the great armies of the light were to unite against the armies of darkness, as happened in Egypt. The hosts of Typhon finally came face to face with the sons of the Golden Hawk. Here was the Armageddon. Here was the Great War. Here was the final alignment of good and evil. That they, in the vanguard of the army of the law, was to ride Gazer of Lynn. Who had waited for a long time for the day. And with him would ride his generals and his captains, those who had waited patiently in the Tushita world for the coming of the King of the World. And this mysterious power was to ride forth with the armies. And then, beside the campfires, men speculated, out under the Mongolian stars. What does this mean? How shall we interpret it? Why do we hear that the Gezer Khan is about to return? How do we know that he is to liberate us from bondage? How do we know that he is to plant the banners of the law upon the highest ramparts of the east? That his flag shall fly and the red-crested spears with their yak-tail pendants would be seen again. What is this secret army that was to rise from the dust, that was to be embodied from the shadows of all things, the secret army to be immaculately conceived, to rise finally as the protectors and the keepers of human destiny, the new order of chivalry? Now, some of the Mongolians, Tibetans, the people of North India, and the Chinese of the five provinces, they were foolish people. They were not all ignorant camel drivers. So they could not just believe in a legend by which there would suddenly appear before them an army such as might have been raised 1,000 years ago by the banners of Genghis Khan. They could not believe this type of coming. There had to be something else. The coming of the King of the World had to have a meaning deeper and more valuable than this. And so the speculation spread into the philosophy itself in Japan, Korea, among the Buddhists of the Diamond Mountain, even among the saints and mystics of Nepal, northern India. Speculation was brought finally into harmony with the teaching itself with which the whole project was involved. The only answer that could possibly mean anything was that a host of entities, souls, would come into the world. This host of souls would arise from a certain and peculiar chemistry. But in this desperate time, the patient ones, the armies of the Lord, the disciples, whose number was beyond legion, they would be the ones who would become the soldiers of the King. Here, everywhere, upon the earth, at a certain time, and according to a certain law, there would be an influx of enlightened souls.
individuality of which we are capable.
These enlightened souls would be the arhats, if we want to call them that.
In reality, there is no freedom.
That incredible array extending beyond the power of vision and the magnificent apocalyptical production of the lotus of the good law. These would be the awakened ones in whose nature the seeds of eternity had been sowed. For it was said, or believed, and the all old Jataka tales of the embodiments of Buddha carry the same message.
And we also
believe that in the course of ages, in the vast cycles of time which have preceded our present day, in every generation, seeds of truth fell into the souls of men.
And
of hope. These are the bija or bija seeds of the Buddha. The Buddha is nothing but a personification of the world truth. Into the souls of men fell these little soul seeds.
Now all of this is not really due to the
but
fact
some of these seeds fell upon sterile ground and they died.
To the fact that some
and some of these seeds fell in the fields and the birds of the air devoured them.
It is simply due
and some of these seeds fell upon good soil,
which the human being has
grew
with him
and multiplied in a wonderful way. For there is nothing greater or more wonderful than the multiplication of the mustard seed. So those in whose souls the seed of the law had been planted, in their various embodiments, were not aware of this. Have no knowledge of it. The mind awakened with birth did not tell them of the old seed. The seed was in the heart. In this, it was good seed. And in the hearts of these, there gradually developed or unfolded the tree of the soul, as mentioned in the mysticism of Sami. There is much of this same concept hidden in the writings of Meister Eckhart. Those in whose soul the seed had found good resting place experienced transformations which they did not understand. In a wonderful way, they became what the Bible might call the salt of the earth. They had within them a great power gradually growing up, the power to serve and to know and to sacrifice for truth. They became the great constructors. They are the ones who gave us the laws. And in Buddhism, all the great teachers of the world are the ones in whose heart the good seeds have been planted. Buddhists would not hesitate to say that Pythagoras or Plato or Michelangelo or Leonardo were all the ones in whom the seeds had been planted. They didn't know it, but something in them longed for beauty. Something in them sought justice, sought a better way. Then these seeds sprinkled so freely also fell into humble hearts, into kindly people who never achieved distinction, but who lived every day a little more kindly than their neighbor, more ready to sacrifice, more easily brought to realize the beauties of wisdom, more ready to develop the eternal emotions which alone are justified. Compassion, appreciation, realization.
These
were the army of the light.
He has to either believe,
for in the great emergency, the light was in them.
Does not believe that.
And in the day of the return of Gazon of Ling, he would call forth the light in the soul. He would see in the souls of all those who possessed it the flickering flame of the doctrine, in some strong and in others weak. But they are his army. The army of those who refuse to die, who refuse to give up beauty, who have died perhaps 100 deaths of pain, but will not die. Each time they come back, the little jewel shines more brightly, the blessed symbol of the blessed Lord. So these thoughtful things, these, in humanity itself, these people, these souls, perhaps they are nearer to us than we realize.
And perhaps right.
That same light is in our own soul. But if this be, then we are banded together to form the army of the Heshefti, the sons of the light.
As we should and survive.
In a certain time.
Going to be a clear
but otherwise things would fail.
Little by little,
these would be called. And out of space, they would come in a great army to be embodied. When they are born, they would not have the slightest idea of their destiny. It would all be wiped out, as it was wiped out of the mind of Gazer of Ling. But these could not refuse their destiny. When the time comes, they will
find that all our
be reminded in a mysterious way of the duty they are here to perform. And when the word reaches them, they will awaken. That is, they will awaken within themselves. This does not mean that they may necessarily still know why they were born. But they will know that they were born, and that this call is the most important thing that has ever come to them. So they will rise and follow in the way of the call. The call itself, of course, is a strange projected phantom, this embodied bodhisattva, Gazer of Ling.
Now, where are these
he symbolizes the awakening. When he arises and speaks, when he gives the great battle cry from the ramparts of Shambhala, then those who are waiting will rise with him. They will instinctively and inevitably become the army of light. For this they were born, whether they know it or not. For this they have lived countless lives, whether they remembered them or not. For those who form this army are the ones that somewhere, sometime, vowed that they would discover the truth. And all that living which they have passed through had a strangely refined something about it, because they were born each time with this instinct for reality. But otherwise, we cannot tell them. But we do know that in this world, some men live for power and others for kindness. Some seek worldly honors and others reject it. Some feel that success is everything and others choose quiet lives of learning. No one knows just why. But it is in the karma of these beings. It is in the core of them. For in some are the soul seeds shining more brightly than in others. In that day, something has to happen by which, in a single moment, those who have received the call and have become embodied as the sons and daughters and children of a generation, was suddenly hear the voice of leadership. They will hear the mysterious order, which in the echoes of ether and in the mystic vibrations of things comes forth in the heart of the Kalasha. They know that the time has come to turn the wheel of destiny. And they will rise, and no army on earth can defeat them. And what will be the kind of war that will be led by the hosts of Gaza Khan? The scholars tell us, and the old yogins who have knowledge of these things, that this will be no bloody warfare. This will be a strange, fatalistic war of light. In this war, there will be no way of telling friend and enemy from the outside. They will mingle together. There will not be any definite battlefield. But there will be a rising of principle against compromise. There will come forth a strong, powerful urge to make straight the way of the Lord. And one by one, the despots will find their followers falling away from them. They will not have the dedication. From the outside, it may seem all a strange freak of circumstance. No one perhaps will know why it all happened. But the cry or the voice of the great generalissimo of the world, Gaza of Lincoln, can be the voice of a great leader. Who knows? When the Orient first became aware of Western history, and they heard the story of Abraham Lincoln, it was commonly agreed that he was a Buddha. Whether he knew it or not wasn't important. All of them do not. But within himself, somewhere, sometime, long ago, the seeds of light were sown. For this light he lived. To keep faith with this light he died.
This is the only way it
he was, in all Eastern way of thinking, one of the Ahats, one of the great teachers of the law. It wasn't important whether he knew it or not. It is only from the inside of things that you can tell. It is only those who have the inner eye that can know the plan that moves behind the face of things.
It's more secure.
But this was the point under consideration. That when the great flying sky horses carried their messages to all parts of the world, some would hear and know. When the banners of Shambhala were unfurled, and the great Tibetan tanker showed the king of Shambhala stepping down from his throne, it meant that the day was near. No one knew how near.
Having received the basis of
no one knew when the great betrayal, the great crisis, in the moment when, according to the Hindu belief, man reaches an extremity which his wisdom is not great enough to assist him to meet. That moment, the Lord of the world comes forth again. So we begin to sense, even at our present day, the coming of this extremity. We realize that not only are we confronted with a great international struggle, but that the struggle is coming onto our streets, into our homes, into our hearts.
integrities of this level,
the forces are arrayed strangely as though on a battlefield. There are no boundaries to this battlefield except boundaries of thought and ideals and principles. Here we have a knight errantry of nobility striving like the Arthurian knights against the strange monsters of corruption. All this we see. We do not know how far it goes. But for some reason along the caravan routes, men knew it was coming. We didn't know, but they did. We thought we were going blissfully on our way, building a great material culture that would bring heaven to earth. But instead of doing so, it is threatening to bring hell to earth. We are no longer secure in these things. But we see in Asia itself the rising of this great turmoil. We were told long ago that the day would come when Tibet would be ravaged, when its holy ones would be destroyed, when its saints would be martyred, when its people would be scattered, but it would suffer also a diaspora by which an innocent people would be cast to the winds. The Tibetans believed this. They knew it was coming. They saw it in the portents of the stars and the rattling of the oracle bones. They knew it was coming. So, they also, by the same prophetic quality, made a kind of analogy that is very, very interesting. It's always interesting to find some small group of ethnic structure, some comparatively slight and fragile nation, likening itself to the whole world, seeing in its own destiny the destiny of humanity, and in its own salvation the salvation of all other men. Tibet had this also. And this they shared with the Eskimo. For the Eskimo believes that ultimately he will rule the world. There's a long way to go, but he may make it if present trends continue. To Tibet, their own country was a microcosm of the whole. The disasters that happened to them were disasters parallel in all other nations. To them, the preservation or restoration of Tibet became a symbol of the restoration of the whole world. To them, therefore, their present catastrophe is a symbol of world catastrophe. They are a little symbol of a great injustice. They are the small, helpless victim. But we shall know what day each one of us shall be a small, helpless victim. But Tibet has been long touched by the grandeur of a concept, of the Mahayana school. According to the Tibetan, there are certain things we have to always remember. But all these disasters that arise through the perfect working of the law. Tibet, at one time, tried to conquer the world in military means. It had a vast domain, no bearing upon its present state. The old Tibetans say, those that were the days when we conquered by the sword. These are the days when we are conquered by the sword. The old wheel has to turn. That which lives by conquest dies in the hands of the conqueror. But it does not die utterly. Nature does not destroy to reprimand. Nature does not take the human soul and cast it into perdition because that soul has karma upon it. No, it is washed away by pain, washed away by suffering and by compensation. And as a result of that, there shall rise again that which is good and true and beautiful in all things.
Most of the mystics have come
the gods themselves, according to Buddhism, cannot change the course of karma. They fall under it as well as mortals. But karma in itself has only one end, the salvation of all that live. Therefore, peoples go down, cultures perish, men go to the grave. The great plan goes on. And this great plan is toward a better kind of world than we have ever known. A world in which the growth of the truth seeds in ourselves will finally bring about the brotherhood of mankind. And Geza of Ling is the soldier of this war. He is the one into whose keeping is this strange pattern of retribution. He is the agent of karma. He must bring things to the destiny that they deserve. And all the time, he is fighting for the light. He is the armed warrior seeking for peace. He is the general who knows that it is the first duty of the general to prevent a war. In this symbolism, the two steps then become obvious. It is Geza of Ling that must clear the way, must lead to the victory of right over wrong, must restore the great structure of the law, like to Krishna in his earliest embodiments. He must dive into the ocean of darkness and preserve the Veda, or the light of the law, from the darkness of the Kali Yuga. So Geza of Ling is the fighter. He is the one that must bring these things about. Who must gradually force the karmic pattern into its proper relationship with truth. When he has accomplished this, he will then lead his armies and his generals, and they will line up in great files of glory before their ramparts, Chang Shambhala. And they shall bring their glory to the King of Kings, to the great Arhat of the color
jump.
He then shall gaze over the calm say,
I have
prepared the way.
From the scripture.
Not by bloodshed,
there is a needle gate, or was,
but by forcing the clarification of truth.
It had to take off its load.
My armies have risen against compromise.
The camels
we have been tired of fighting wrong. There came into the world those who rose against evil and overthrew it, rose against corruption and cast it down, rose against tyranny, and tyranny is no more. Then, according to the ancient legends, the kings of the world, the great Arhats of Shambhala, will prepare for the next great cycle. In that time, they shall announce the coming of the Lord Maitreya. This is the body of the legend. Now, the thought of the thing is very important, I think. How shall we ever be able to solve the problem we see around us every day? The only answer probably that is possible is that at the appointed time, the great army of souls held in suspension behind the veil of life will move into embodiment together. If this happens at any time, then the generation that follows must be greatly altered. Then ulterior motive will not find its victim. For these dedicated souls will not be lured by the hypnosis of evil. They will not be corrupted by selfishness or self-centeredness. The moment we produce a powerful army of the incorruptible, corruption is gradually destroyed. So the Geza Khan legend means to the Tibetans and the Mongolians that an army of souls waits to be born. And when the trumpet sounds, they will be born. And when they do come into the world, they will be the soldiers of the guardian king. They will be the soldiers of the great law keeper, the guardians of the temples and the sanctuaries, the Neil and the Tenno, all of the strange and wonderful symbols of the protectors of inevitables. For each of these guardians stands at one of the four directions of space and is obligated to see that the great wheel is never destroyed, to protect value, that the valueless shall never triumph. And the Tibetans and Mongolians believe that this is the way, and that the moving in to the human race of these wiser souls is the answer. Under normal conditions, these wiser ones are assumed to come in one here, one there, according to the needs of times and places. But when the need is universal, when problems are no longer limited to nations or races or small parts of the earth, but the problems are the whole earth, then they cannot be solved by one entering here and another there to find the ear of a thoughtful ruler. Now the great legions of the Arhats, described in the Lotus Sutra, extending as far as the eyes can see, in every direction of space, these legions fade out of the heavenly worlds and are born as infants, to grow up, to pass through all experiences that we know, but to have within them the priceless treasure of the flaming jewel, by which in their own hearts they can never be corrupted. These are the armies of light. These are the soldiers of Gazer of Ling. And in the light of this, I think the whole story takes on a very dramatic and rather inspiring aspect. And perhaps you will find it worth thinking about. Thank you very much.